Committee to order. Today we have a very fascinating agenda today. We have a presentation from the Director of the Tax Restructuring Committee, Mr. Shetterly, and others. And so, do we open a hearing on this, or do we just...
Informational hearing.
Oh, open an informational hearing on that subject. Did you want to say anything first, Paul?
Madam Chair, I did include in your packet here the outline, the comprehensive revenue restructuring framework for the task force. This kind of is a rough guideline for the work that's being done, and then there's a little schematic on the back, and Lane will go through that with you as the chair and kind of how that fits in with the plan for the task force.
Now, so we'll call Lane Shetterly, and do you want to come up together?
Yes.
George Naughton?
I might add, too, Madam Chair, that as you recall, the legislation does have Legislative Revenue Office staffing the task force, so we're intimately involved.
Because Legislative Revenue staff didn't have enough to do already.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly here before you today in my capacity as chair of the House Bill 2530 Task Force on Revenue Restructuring, and with me is George Naughton, State Budget Director. I will be making some introductory comments on the implementation of the bill to give you just a sense of what the status is today of the task force, and I will address that one of the things that we are looking at in the work of the task force is beginning some baseline evaluation of our revenue system, and that includes a sense of current that is projections based on the current system, and that's where George will come in, not biennial forecast as we know that you saw recently, but this is more a long-term forecast so that we can do some long-term thinking about impacts of the revenue system as we move forward into the final 8 or 9 months of the task force's work. If I may, Madam Chair, I want to just particularly greet Senator Haas. His first time I've had a chance to be in front of him since his reentry to the legislature and in the years that we shared on the House Revenue Committee. It's great to see him back up on a Revenue Committee dais. So
it's great for us to have him as well.
Well, he got a good training in the House. All right. House Bill 2530 was passed, as you know, in the last legislative session. It created a task force on comprehensive revenue restructuring consisting of 30 members. It's a daunting size, but it's working well so far. Members, including voting members and non-voting members as well. The charge of the task force was to evaluate the revenue system that the state has in place and develop a blueprint for comprehensive revenue restructuring for local and state government. That's an important component of this work group that we consider very front and center to our work, that it's not just a state revenue restructuring task force, but also focusing on local component. As you know, I'm sure, from the interaction you're having with local governments, the needs and issues at local government are every bit as great, and in many cases even greater than what we face at the state. So that makes the work of this task force bigger, but also, I think, more essential to include that local component. And the blueprint that the bill calls out for is to provide a means for promoting stable revenue for all levels of state and local government, creating positive economic benefits for Oregon, and creating a financial foundation that will increase Oregon's ability to compete in a global economy. So it's a very broad, very ambitious charge, but one that I think brings some excitement to the table for those who have been selected and agreed to serve as members of the task force. We have work to finish by the end of this year. I think the bill gives us until November to prepare recommendations to the legislature. We began meeting last November. We met in November and December and January. We've taken this month off because of the special session, especially respecting the work that is entailed for the Legislative Revenue Office. But in the three meetings that we have had as a task force, we have begun at least to identify how we want to go about our work for the remaining time that we have. We have also spent a good bit of time in laying down a foundation of basic knowledge about our revenue system and some of the challenges that we face. I thought that was important. We're bringing 30 people from around the state, each of whom come with a high degree of expertise and knowledge about particular areas of state and local revenue and expenditures, but no one with the full comprehensive understanding. It was important for us to begin our first meetings with a good grounding in facts about the revenue system, so we've done that. We have looked at both the state revenue system and local revenue system challenges that they face, and as George will share with you most recently in our last meeting, a look forward at the state forecast. So we begin to see what the landscape is out there into which we are moving as we begin to formulate recommendations. In terms of the major elements of the task force, I think you have a handout in front of you that fairly well identifies that. I'll be brief on that because I want to leave time for George to walk you through some of the forecasting that we have done. But first, we wanted an evaluation that includes projected needs and resources over the next 12 years. That's sort of our time frame, looking out about basically to 2020. So that, again, we know if we make changes today in our revenue system, how is that going to affect us, not just in the next biennium, but what effects will that have in the biennia out to that 2020 timeline. Interestingly, and I think this is probably one of the most fundamental senses that we've gotten so far of our in the work of the task force, I think what we've seen and what you will see with George's projections here, we regard the revenue system as something of a significant asset to the state. That is, if you look out over time, you will see that in terms of if you accept stasis, that is what we are doing now today, and I'm sure there's lots of room for argument whether that's too much or too little, but if you accept what we are doing now today, you have a long-term forecast that looks fairly adequate, and maybe even a little more than adequate, although with some caveats that George will touch on, for continuing at least a basic level of services at the state level. We're not talking about local governments now. And revenue to meet that over the long term. Again, the changes on a biennium to biennium basis can be dramatic, but in the long term, we look fairly secure in terms of our ability to meet a current level of needs and programs. That's an asset, and we're very cognizant of that, that changes we make to either increase programs or to decrease revenues is going to have an effect on that in the not only immediate but in the out years. And so we're very cognizant of that in looking at our revenue system. We are going to be involved in a process of public engagement as we move into the spring and over the summer. It is important, I think, to have public input on this. Those of you who sit on revenue committees, and I share the sense that sometimes we feel like we've heard it all. What value could there be for another town hall meeting on tax reform? But I think it's important for number one, because being the inveterate optimist that I am, I always think that one idea that nobody's yet thought of might be the one that comes out tonight. And secondly, I think that's important just in terms of the exercise that the public have the ability to meet face-to-face with decision-makers who are going to be making recommendations to the legislature and to the governor. And so we will be moving forward in the spring and summer into a process of public engagement, also using technology through Paul's work, the website at the Legislative Revenue Office, so that we can maintain that kind of two-way flow of information even between meetings. And then we have committees that will be looking at, that is subcommittees of the work group that will be looking at short-term responses and long-term responses. As we begin to look at projected needs and resources and we begin to receive input from task force members and outside of the task force in the way of recommendations, we need to know, first of all, are those short-term or are those long-term? Is that something that you could come back in 2009 and enact with a bill straight up and we would know what we would have in terms of a product? Or is it something that would be more long-term that might devolve into a legislative work group and perhaps even at some point in the future a statewide vote and a constitutional amendment to do one thing or another. So as we look at the projected resources and needs and see where that drives us in terms of possible changes in the revenue system, we will be evaluating those as to short-term and long-term responses and then making recommendations accordingly. On the back of the sheet that you have is sort of the diagram of that. There is a subcommittee or a sub-work group of the task force associated with each of these. We've already met on a couple of occasions with the projected needs, resources and needs group. That is the one that has worked with George in developing what you will see in a few minutes. We'll have a group developing a program for public engagement, and then we've had members volunteer to serve on the short-term and long-term response sub-work groups as well, to begin to evaluate for the task force information and proposals that come forward to us. One last thing that I will share with you is the work of the Advisory Council. In addition to creating the task force, House Bill 2530 also established the Oregon Revenue Advisory Council to consist of economists, tax attorneys, and accountants. That group serves as something of our technical advisory committee, although they're smart enough that they go way beyond technical and I think are very helpful in terms of some of the policy implications as well, at least to evaluate those for the full task force. But that group has met now as well. They're meeting, I think, Thursday this week again. High-quality group of individuals with a vast amount of knowledge and experience in dealing with Oregon's revenue system, both on the theoretical side and as we get down to tax attorneys and accountants, also on the very practical side. And I think their assistance will be of great effect for the work of the task force overall. I want to thank Senators Monroe and Burdick and Morse for their work on the task force as being members as well. We have House members and several citizen members, many of whom travel very far to attend our meetings, but the interest among members has been high, and I've been very impressed with that, and I think the energy is there to be a very functional and effective work group. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my remarks and maybe segue into George in about 30 seconds because I think staff, I forgot to give them about a minute heads up. They're all set. Good. They could tell I was winding down. They are so good. So thank you. I think if you have a question, I'm happy to answer it now. Otherwise, you may want to see what George will be presenting, and then we'll be happy to engage with you either way.
Other questions? Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton. I'm the administrator of the Budget and Management Division. Several of you have seen this presentation before. It is basically the same presentation that we gave. It is the same presentation that was given to the Revenue Restructure Task Force in late January of this year. We're going to run through a number of these things fairly quickly because for those of you who are in the legislature, much of this history is already well known to you, what we went through in the 1990s through the recession in 2001-03 and then ultimately the rebound that we had in 2003 forward. And then we'll give you the projections, which is what I'll spend most of my time on today. Now, what I will do is I'm going to run through these first series of slides very quickly. And if you have questions, please feel free to stop me. But again, I want to get to the information, which is more about the projections, and spend most of our time on that. So I'm going to run through just real high level the slides that we have here just so you see them in your packet. If you have any questions, again, stop me, but I'm going to run through these very, very quickly. We started with just a conversation about the 1990s and what has happened with Oregon's economy since that time. Some highlights of the strong growth in our economic sectors, and you'll see the number of things that we were leading the nation or close to the top of the nation in. Note at the bottom of the slide that kicker kicked on the personal side 7 times and 5 times on the corporate side, sending back a large amount of money back to tax filers in the state of Oregon. This is simply population growth, and you notice the green is where the large areas of population growth occurred in Oregon. The green primarily you see in the Portland metropolitan area and then in certain sectors throughout the rest of the country. The ones in Morrow County and Malheur County are related to increases in prison populations or new prisons that were brought online. So there's skewing of some of the data in those counties because of that. This is just simply a slide of K through 12 funding from the 1990s before ballot measure 5, and you'll see the flip-flop. The dark blue is state funding. The light shaded section is local funding. You see after ballot measure 5 went into effect, virtually a reversal of where the primary funding of K-12 is. And then this is also some changes also led by voter-approved initiatives. This is ballot measure 11. There were a series of ballot measures in the 1990s related to public safety that increased populations or inmate populations that the state covered. And this is the first biennium, to my knowledge, who haven't actually built a new prison online. So things have started to slow down. All of that in the 1990s led us to where we were in 2001-03 when we went through our recession. And this slide simply points out the magnitude of the revenue drop that occurred. When we started the close of session at the end of the 2001 session, we had $11.45 billion of general fund. You'll see by the time we reached December 2002, that number had dropped to 9.6. So almost $2 billion dropped off of the ledgers. And that led to the 5 special sessions and the one during the regular session in 2003 for those that were around. This is simply a chart of poverty rates. You notice that the yellow is where... I'm trying to look at this. The black sections that you see there is where over 15% of the population lived in poverty in 1999. This next slide, kicking forward, you notice that 6 more counties moved into that area where 15% or more of the population lived under more than 15% of the population lived under the federal poverty level. The reason we point this slide out is just simply to emphasize that even when our economy is going down, as many of you know, we're counter-cyclical for a number of our programs. Demand in our human services programs increased during recessions, as they also do in our university system, where as people lose jobs, they move back into the university system to increase their education.
Question?
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Gillum County, is that the effect of the landfill and all of the garbage that the Portland area ships out that way? Because it's a small county in terms of population, and there's a lot of jobs created by that landfill and the truckers that truck that stuff up and down the gorge.
Senator Burdick, Senator Monroe, actually I don't know the answer to that question. That's something we could take a look at as to what, you're right though, the population is small enough there, that could be what was one of the drivers, but we can look into that.
Thank you.
I'm going to skip through this slide. This is simply a comparison of various points of time of how much of the state budget, general fund and lottery fund, went into particular sectors. The writing is small in here, and for most folks that can't read it, even I'm having a hard time, especially on the top one. The main point, though, is just the change in the state school fund moving from being roughly 25% of the state budget to now being over 40% of our state budget now. And then the other thing is that the places that were squeezed out during that period of general fund and lottery funds were our university system, where it contract significantly. We'll have a slide about that a little bit later on. And in the all other category, which is where a number of services, whether it be transportation services, natural resources services, where they were historically funded with general fund or lottery funds and now have moved into a user fee base. And so if you actually look at the state budget overall now, probably 50% of our expenditures are other funds. The general fund makes up about a quarter of those, actually a little bit more than that. But the large shift to user fees, user-based fees. After the recession in 2001-03, we had the rebound that led to tremendous growth, revenue growth for us most recently. And this slide is just pointing out a number of the strengths of our economy. And you on the Revenue Committee are very familiar with these. We continue to be very well positioned. Our position on the Pacific Rim, our diversified economy, fairly well-educated workforce, our housing prices, even though they've gone up recently, compared to the rest of the country, we're still in pretty good position. And again, strong population growth or in-migration from other states continues to help us. We have a series of slides here about employment trends. The blue line on top is Oregon. The line down below low is the U.S. You notice that in the recent period, 2004 through 2006, our employment growth grew much stronger than the rest of the country. And you'll see the projections going forward from 2007 on. And these slides came from the Office of Economic Analysis, where they're continuing to project that Oregon's employment growth is going to be stronger than the rest of the country. The converse unemployment trends, you'll see that when we went into our recession in 2001 through 2003, our unemployment rates grew or were higher than the rest of the country. So with the corresponding flip of that, when our economy is doing well and the type of recession that hit us in 2001-03 particularly hit the type of industries that Oregon runs. And so that was why we saw the impact there. This is the general fund lottery forecast from the December 2007, and you are all very familiar now that we've had another forecast come out in February. All the continuing slides that you're going to see have not been updated, I'll repeat that, have not been updated for the February 2008 revenue forecast by the Office of Economic Analysis. We will update a number of these slides after the supplemental session gets done. But this was just trying to compare out what has been our general fund growth since 1994 forward. And you'll see, looking at that hash line, the blue line that goes forward, at the December 2007 forecast line, it was actually coming close to what our close of session forecast was in 2001. Now, that picture has obviously changed, and we will, again, be updating these as we move forward. This is the lottery fund picture. Two things I want to highlight here. One is that as lottery funds had line games introduced to them, that is about in the 2005 forward period, you saw the tremendous growth in our lottery fund resources. And that is primarily driven by the addition of line games into the system. We are now in a period where the lottery fund projections, that system is becoming more mature, and we're expecting the rate of growth of lottery funds to come back to a more historical growth projections. The other thing I'll notice here is that as lottery funds have increased, we've had larger and larger portions of that dedicated to particular sources, whether it be the Education Stability Fund, the Parks Fund, or to debt service for projects that are tied to lottery fund resources. This is the general fund and lottery fund picture at the close of session back this last June. You'll see that of resources, we had about $15.3 billion of general fund, lottery fund combined resources, and we had projected expenditures of about $15.1 billion. Those obviously came down with the revenue projections. We've not made any changes on the expenditure side yet. Those are being currently discussed down the hall in Ways and Means. The revenue picture has dropped by leaving ending balance. What was $200 million at this point is closer to $45 million is what we're looking at now, between $45 and $50. The one thing that is very important for us is we look at our revenue picture, and all of you, very important part of bringing this all together was the creation of those rainy day funds. I will tell you that as the treasurer and myself and others go back and talk with our bond rating agencies now, they're very pleased to see that Oregon has now created the Education Stability Fund, the Rainy Day Fund, and our ending balances. When we go back and talk with them about the fact that projected at the end of 2007-09, assuming that our revenues continue to be strong and we don't have to tap into some of those resources, you're looking at reserves of somewhere in the $800 to $1 billion mark, which is a good position for us. And the one thing I will say is that from a fiscal perspective, as you see the charts later on, as we talk about revenues and the volatility of revenues, it is important for us, because our revenue system fluctuates dramatically, while the numbers you see forward of this are going to be long-term averages, we all know that in any one two-year budget period, there can be some pretty significant deviations. So setting aside these resources to help us weather that is very important. One of the things that hit us very hard during the...
Excuse me, Senator Morris.
Excuse me. Your earlier reference, George, to the current status of our ending fund balance, did that include the emergency fund?
The ending balance was about $200 million. Yes, $200 million, and then there was $30 million on top of that for the emergency fund.
Right, but you had referenced $50 million.
No, that is just what was projected between general fund and lottery fund ending balances.
Okay, thank you.
And there still is $30 million of emergency fund resources that have not yet been tapped.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jenny. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, and, you know, let's not pat ourselves on the back too much over that $1 billion approximately in reserves, because noting that in 01 to 03, we had a drop of $2 billion. And so to really be prudent, we should be looking at reserves of at least $2 billion.
And Madam Chair, if I may, and Senator Monroe, that's actually one of the questions that's been posed to the Advisory Council to evaluate how big a reserve fund should we have as a matter of policy. Clearly, you want it to be enough to get through a foreseeable downturn in the economy. There's a downside, too, of creating too big a reserve fund where you're putting money aside that could better be used probably for current programs and services. And so we've asked the Advisory Council to do an evaluation of reserve funds, and we'll be bringing that back to the task force. And that will inform the very issue that Senator Monroe raised, how big should the reserve fund be, and we'll make recommendations on that, I anticipate.
Thank you. Continue.
This slide is one that the Treasurer's Office put together simply to show the growth of the reserve funds over time. The change is those green hash lines you see moving forward, which are the contributions into the rainy day fund. As you, all of you, are very much aware, I do have to spend some time talking about this with external groups, because there's actually still a fair amount of misinformation about whether or not the rainy day fund actually grows, and I'm not understanding how that mechanism actually works. I won't spend a lot of time with this group because you're much more familiar with that. All of that leads to what we're looking forward to as far as budget drivers. And the next series of slides are, again, work that was done in conjunction with the governor's office, primarily back during the fall as they were doing long-range planning, and then we synced up with the revenue restructuring task force that was going on. Most of this information, and you'll see it in a few minutes, the revenue side is based, again, on the December 2007 forecast. And the expenditure side is based on information that my office put together back in the fall. We will be refreshing this information again after the supplemental session goes home as we continue budget planning and preparation for putting the governor's recommended budget together. But looking at the first part of this, which is the revenue methodology, the revenue part of it was developed by Tom Sikowski's office in the Office of Economic Analysis. And for the short term, the next 4 to 6 years, it is based on the work that they do in projecting out Oregon's economy. In the outer years, and most of the work that you will see will run out to 2019 through 21, which for budget purposes is a very long horizon. For my purpose on the expenditure side, the first 2 to 4 years I have a pretty good feel for. Beyond that, it becomes more speculative on our side, and there's some assumptions built into it. On the revenue side of it, the work you'll see here, these are the underlying assumptions behind Tom's work, and you'll see that's based on or modeled on the relationships between various variables. In the outer years, it's based on some long-term averages. So as you look out in the out years on these next revenue forecast lines, you'll see them reverting to a mean, which is revenue growth of about 13% general fund, lottery fund combined. The primary revenue drivers for us, as you are all very well aware, is employment growth and what's happening in our state economy, which ties in wage rates, investment returns, and profit levels. There are some other dynamics, though, that Tom's shop is starting to spend more time looking at, which is what is going to be the impact of, as baby boomers retire and move more of their resources, what happens to the tax base in our state? Being that we are primarily a income tax, personal income tax-driven revenue source, we have to start paying attention to what happens as a large section of our demographics changes over time, and how does that potentially impact us. So those, they're not underlying assumptions in this forecast or these numbers you'll see here built into that, but I want you to be aware that something we are starting to take a look at, or Tom Shop is starting to look at.
Senator Monroe.
And isn't it true from population demographics that they're saying that in the next 20 years that Oregon will tend to have a higher percentage of people in that over 65 age group than the nation as a whole?
Chair Burdick, Senator Monroe, I do believe that is correct.
Yeah.
And we have some slides in a little bit that will point out some of the changes in our demographic groups.
On the retirement income, now that's still taxable. So how does your model work? on that.
Madam Chair, I'll actually turn to Paul. He has much more expertise on this than I do.
Madam Chair, we treat there are certain tax expenditures based on age, such as Social Security being excluded from income in our state constitution. We've talked about the senior elderly medical subtraction for those 62 and above. We estimate that that reduces income tax revenue by about $100 million a biennium now. So we anticipate those types of things. There's also an additional standard deduction for people over 65. So all of those factors are captured in our tax calculator, micro simulation model. The thing that we're working on and work in conjunction with budget management and the Office of Economic Analysis would be to age our sample of taxpayers to see how that would affect our revenue, everything else the same. We do have a report that Minnesota did, Minnesota Department of Revenue, that did that. They took their demographers' projections for 2030 and said, okay, everything else the same, let's assume our age distribution is like it is in 2030 and see how that affects our revenue. For them, their revenue went down by about 3%, but they tax Social Security like the federal government does, and they don't have the elderly medical subtraction. So we're thinking that our impact probably at least double that in terms of the impact on the tax base, everything else the same.
Of course, at the same time, the program needs increase with the aging population.
Yes. Absolutely correct. This is the compilation of Tom's work, or Office of Economic Analysis work. You'll notice that in 2009-11, they're projecting growth of about 11%. And again, this is the December 2007 forecast. Based on the forecast in February 2008 that just came out, that 2009-11 number goes down by about $166 million. So right off the bat, I know that the numbers we're looking at on the revenue side, these numbers will start to come down. In the out years, starting at about 2013-15, you'll see that the numbers come back up, and the numbers there, even though they're small, come right about 13% rate of growth over time for those each one of those out years. And these are the general fund is in blue, and the lottery fund resources are on the top, which is the darker shaded section. But long-term growth at about 13%. And you'll see that we're coming back to that mean during 2009-11. This is about 11%, and 2011-13, which OEA is projecting at about 12%. So for the next two bienniums, a little bit flatter than we have recently seen.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Morris.
And that factors in the economic cycle?
Still
would have a sustained growth of that magnitude?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, what these are is long-term averages. And Tom will tell, when we've talked about this in the past, he is quick to point out that these are averages, and any 1-2-year period may be significantly higher or significantly lower than that. One of the conversations for the task force is actually how do you capture those growth years, and how do you harness that growth that's occurring and not lose those resources? Because for any one of these 2-year periods, it can be significantly above or below these numbers.
I can add, Madam Chair, just these trend projections, you look back historically on the forecasting, they've been pretty accurate in terms of what those trends are. The problem, as George pointed out, is we're not very good at anticipating the turning point in the cycle, and that's where we've had issues. The other problem that we've had is that, you know, you tend to build into this long-term trend, and if you project that trend off of a cyclical peak, you end up with a much higher number than you should act, than actually reality is going to be. So it's also determining where you are in the cycle and then projecting the trend.
Kind of like global warming.
Very similar.
Madam Chair, moving to the next section, which is the expenditure side. We have the general approach, actually, the primary drivers on the expenditure side are driven by population changes. As we have more people come into the system, we have more school children coming into the system, more demand on the human services system, more people accessing or becoming inmates that we have to serve through our prison populations. So population is a major driver, and we will have a series of three slides where we talk about the different demographic projections for different groups depending on what types of services they receive from us. The other big drivers, as you saw in the earlier part of this presentation, voter-approved initiatives have a very large impact on the state's budget. Whether it be ballot measure 5 changing state school funding, public safety initiatives that drive new inmate population growth, or other things that limit, quite frankly, budget growth or revenue growth within the state system. So we are every 2 years when we're putting the governor's budget together, very concerned about what new initiatives may be approved by the voters in that coming cycle. So we are very tied to that. The third one there is legislative policy decisions. As you make decisions, and the governor concurs with those also make big changes in what may be happening in the state budget. And as an example of that, the Oregon Health Plan, when it was approved, during the 90s, we had a large amount of growth in that system, primarily driven by a policy choice that all of you made. Those things also drive the budget. Finally, and this is the big concern for me longer term, outside the demographics, the federal government, as they have to deal with their own budget shortfalls, I am fully expecting that they will start to ramp back the amount of resources that they provide to state governments, state and local governments. We're seeing that in with the county payments issue. We're also seeing that in a host of smaller issues in state government already, whether it be the employment department or other programs that the federal government has historically participated in. I'm fully expecting that over time they will start to back away from some of these, either moving them to capped programs or block-granted programs, trying to limit their exposure, especially as they move into dealing with their own Medicare issues and Social Security issues. I expect those pressures to mount. Secondary factors for us are inflation-related. I think most of you are aware of the dynamics in the healthcare market. As we build in projections on the healthcare system in particular, it becomes very difficult to project what those are going to look like. Inflationary factors overall are pretty easy to calculate, but it's the medical costs in particular that are very difficult. And then finally, lawsuits. We have had a series of lawsuits in the past that drive additional costs within state government, whether it be within our developmental disability community, whether it be in our school system or in other areas where there are services that we may not be providing as well as others would like, and the court system is certainly an impact on how that works for us.
Another lawsuit that just another court decision that just had an impact was the Clark decision on the tort cap. Have you had a chance to analyze that? Is that reflected in any of these projections?
Chair Burdick, they are not built into any of the projections you'll see in this. There's a lot of work actually currently going on to decide how the state needs to respond to that, and I'm sure that will be a legislative issue for the next biennium, for the next legislative session, to figure out how that should work. There's a lot of legal work right now going on trying to figure out what is the extent of how far Clark actually goes, and there's a lot of work going on behind of it, but there's nothing built into these projections at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sure.
Monroe.
Yeah, the federal budget adjustments, the big items there are, of course, the entitlement programs. You mentioned those. And the other big item is military spending.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us thought that when the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union dismantled itself a decade ago, that our need for huge growth in military expenditures was over. But current administration has seen otherwise, so it could make a huge difference in terms of whether or not we try to live in a world at peace or keep having one little war after another. I don't think that was a question. I think that was a
statement. Now we know where you stand on this. Go ahead.
So, generally speaking, the expenditure side information you're going to see, and I want to walk through the methodology for a second because there's some inherent risks in the way that my shop has put this together. I want you to be aware of it. What we did is basically used the same methodology that we use for building the budget in the next two-year period, which we refer to as the central budget level. And it basically starts with a baseline of what the legislature approved for programs, and then maintains those programs into the next biennium. So it does not make any assumptions about new programs coming online, new voter-approved initiatives, new changes in the federal government where they move more resources away from us. It is basically looking at what we currently do and projecting those costs forward. We add in or make changes based on costs of programs that may have started up partway through the biennium, and we also eliminate costs for programs that may be disappearing. And as an example of both of those, in the projections that we've done out through 2019-2021, we've built in the costs of building two new state hospitals and two new corrections facilities out there, because that is anticipated in the decisions that this body has already made. We also pull money off as debt service costs disappear because we paid those loans off. So we've built in those things that we know are occurring, but we do not build in any new costs for things that have not already been approved by this body.
Okay, you mentioned the two prisons. Does that take into account the bill that we recently passed on property offenders? Or
Chair Burdick, no, it does not. So that would, if that were approved, that would be additional costs on top of what are in these numbers that we already have.
Thank you.
Again, because this work was all done back in the fall, back in 2007. So those policy decisions, and quite frankly, that is partly what we'll be updating once all of you go home. We'll be re-looking at these numbers again to come up with newer assumptions. We've then added inflationary cost increases. I've talked about those a little bit. For certain programs, we add in population changes, and those are based on whether primarily within our public safety programs, inmate changes, and within a number of our entitlement programs within our human services systems, and within our K-12 system, we add in the cost of population changes for school-aged children. It does not build in caseload growth, for example, for our higher education system. Those are not built into these kind of projections. So that those increase folks accessing our higher education system would be policy packages that ultimately be brought in front of you, but are not built into these numbers here. And then again, we build in the changes in federal funding for some of those mandated caseload programs. Again, only the federal changes that have already been announced by the federal government. And then finally, we make changes for the changes in debt service for new prisons coming online or debts being paid off. There is an inherent downward bias in this approach, and this is the important thing for me to mention to you, in that as we eliminate program, because we're not adding dollars for new programs that have not yet been approved, but we are pulling away dollars for things like loans that have been paid off, there's an inherent slight downward bias in our expenditure projections. And Paul and I, when we were first talking about these, laughed about the fact that predecessors in my job have always complained that these numbers always look rosier than they are. It is important to notice, as you see some of these projections we move to in a few minutes, the gap between our revenues, and I'm alluding to it clearly now, our expenditure growth actually is slightly lower than what our revenue growth is, and you'll see that in the charts. It may actually be a little closer because of this inherent downward bias, but we still at this point would be projecting that there would be some cushion or room to make policy decisions moving forward. So let me start moving into the demographic changes, because I think these are important for all of you to understand. This is our young age population, children ages 0 to 17. These are important to us because this is our K-12 populations. The things to note here is that as I look at the slice here, and the two lines that you see going up and down are the current biennium we're in, 2007-09. As I look at these charts moving forward, it's a fairly moderate rate of growth in this K through 12 system. It is growth, and in fact, if you look at these closely, rates of growth for the 5 through 17 population is actually a little faster than what we've in the most recent past seen, but it's a fairly moderate level of growth. This is the working age population, and you'll see the blue line is the age 45 to 64. That's the group in the middle. That is, generally speaking, the high income growth period for most folks. You'll see that we've had tremendous growth in that area from about 1990 all the way to the current period. And as the baby boom generation starts to age out of the 64 cohort, that group will actually taper off. So this will be a concern for our revenue generating side as we talk with our economic and revenue forecasters. The other group I'll note here is just the age 18 to 24 group. We pay attention to that in the budget world because those are folks that move into our higher education system, or they also have a propensity to move into our inmate population. So that group, as I look at it, that's where the exposure is. Again, looking at the higher education system, and I talked a minute ago that we don't build in mandated caseload growth for that age cohort. Looking at these numbers, even if you looked at the age group, the age cohorts, it's fairly moderate growth over the next several years. This is the one that concerns me long term, and this is our elderly population. The top line is the 65 to 74 group, and you'll notice that the rapid growth beginning in about 2005, that is the aging of the baby boom generation, and you see that rapid growth as it takes on for the next 20 or so years. For my purposes in the budget world, we are really looking at the 75-plus population. For the group people that were on the task force previously, there's not a lot of folks that come into our long-term care system in the 65 to 74 group. It's really after age 75 where people fall and break a hip and then move into our long-term care system or need additional health care costs. We are expecting at this point that that 75-plus group is going to stay fairly stable, and we may have a window of opportunity here until it really starts to take off, as you see in the 65 to 74 group, closer to the 2015-2017 range. So we may have a little bit of breathing room on the state-run Medicaid programs for the elderly, given the dynamics of when people start to access our system.
Going back, Madam Chair, if I may, going back to our conversation earlier about the revenue impacts, while the 75 to 84 age cohort is the one that requires the most in the way of public programs and services, I think we can't ignore the impact of that ramp up in the 65 to 74 population, because those are the folks who will become eligible for the senior medical and the Social Security and those other factors that will reduce revenue off of that population. So even though they're not demanding or requiring that much in George's world in terms of programs and services, there is a revenue impact as people move into that age group.
All of that leads to our long-term expenditures. This is like the revenue side. This is what our projections are by various groups, whether it be our education, which is the bottom section, human services, the darker blue, public safety and judicial, which is the yellow, and then the all other category. And we're projecting growth in the near term of closer to 12.5%. And then it tapering off as we go forward. And again, some of this may be the downward bias I talked about before. Behind all of those numbers, and we'll get to the chart that lays out the revenues and expenditures side by side in just a moment, but there's some underlying assumptions I want to point out to you, and I just want to note here that they're in your packet if you want to take a more detailed look at some of these. I do want to point out that of all the programs in front of us, especially the human services sector is the one that is the most prone to policy changes and changes in the demographics or the need that's out there. Remember at the very beginning of this, I showed you a chart in 2001-03 of what the people living under the federal poverty level and how that changed during a recession. As we move into recessionary periods, larger numbers of people start losing health care, for example, from their employer, and then they come looking to the state for assistance in a variety of different ways, whether it be additional health care, child care costs, or some areas where they may access actually our cash assistance programs. So demand goes up. We are countercyclical in that demand goes up during those down periods. When I say that it's prone to policy changes, however, even if populations or the need is driven, for example, in the fact that we're going through a major recession, there are policy decisions that this body makes that can ultimately alleviate the pressures on the budget side of it by either increasing access to services or decreasing it. And the example that I used with the task force is that when I look back historically at the 1980s, which is one of the worst recessions that on the employment side that the state worked through, and I also compare that to the adult welfare group within the human services system. Even though the demand clearly went up, the number of people served in our system was virtually flat as a board for about 10 years. And it was because of policy decisions that were made to alleviate pressure on the state budget to limit the number of people that could access in. So that sector in particular, if we choose to expand access, all the demographic stuff we've talked about may be exacerbated, or if we choose to limit services, again, just to point out the impact that policy decisions have on this system. And the public safety system, I just wanted to point out that one of the main things that's not built into here, and it was alluded to earlier by the chair, is there is, and we'll talk about this in a moment, there's a potential voter-approved initiative out there that we'll be looking at potentially in November, or other alternatives that are being brought forward. Those numbers have not been built into this. But this leads to the long-term chart with the revenues and expenditures together, and point out that 2007-09, there's a little bit of inversion here, but the main message is for 2007-09 through about 2011-13, our revenues expenditures are virtually balanced. Now, for budget purposes, I look at those two lines, and they're within 100, 200 million of each other, which means for my purposes, they're close enough that they're virtually equal. Now, again, our February 2008 forecast dropped the revenues in the next budget period by about $166 million, but still virtually balanced. Going out into the out years, though, you see that we actually have this investment window where that will be filled most likely by decisions that are made by this body or by voters on where are we going to spend the state's resources. And right now, based on the numbers that we've been looking at, we do think that in the long term, there's a little bit of a gap between, or not a gap, a surplus, if you will, of where our revenues are growing faster than what our expenditures. Looking back historically, there are policy decisions that are made to bring those closer together. And I think that's the main issue for this body, is as you look at potentially having an investment window there, where do you make those choices that benefit Oregonians in general long term?
I guess it's hard for me to understand why you could have this surplus here, given the previous charts that mentioned the impacts of the aging population, both in terms of reduced revenue and increased demand on services. Was this surprising to you to see this?
Actually, it wasn't too surprising when we first started looking at it because, again, the revenues start to grow faster, and where we're looking at the growth in our senior population doesn't actually hit until 2015 to 2017. So we're actually projecting in the near term a lot of our expenditure growth to be fairly mitigated for the next several years, and then it's starting to clip up after that. So it wasn't surprising to me to see this because, again, it's in the longer term where this jumps out.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
Maybe you said this and I missed it, George. Is this factored in any way, the kickers refunds?
Chair Burdick, Senator Hess, no, it does not. It does not project any kickers going out, and that would be also a good point that if we have kickers, would be reducing in large, could be potentially in large amounts.
Well, I would think so. I mean, in the 90s, that was about $2 billion.
Senator Hess, we did kind of average the kickers. It's been around long enough, and what we found over time is that it reduces general fund revenue by about 3% a biennium on average. Or sometimes it's zero, sometimes it's 6%, but on average it's about 3% per biennium.
That's a lot of money. But that's not there, though, right? Or is it?
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Monroe.
And the property crimes measures, dueling measures. So it's not a matter of whether we'll get one or nothing. We will get one or the other. You know, we'll either get the $80 million problem or the $200 million problem. And you haven't focused either one of those there. Other things, the bonds on the latest max line, you know, run out in 2010. What do? We replaced them with bonds for the next max line, and probably we'll do that again. And so, you know, I just think the expenditure line, you know, is very conservative.
Chair Burdick, Senator Monroe, I think that is actually why I'm not surprised these numbers on the expenditure side are lower, because exactly as Senator Monroe is saying, we are expecting that there are going to be some large expenditures that tail off as that debt is paid off. We don't assume that they're backfilled with new projects out there, even though chances are pretty good that they will be.
Well, and our higher ed facilities are aging and in need of significant investments, shall we say.
Correct.
It's just infrastructure things. There's just a lot of needs out there that you haven't anticipated in that expenditure line.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, I was just going to offer, I think the committee's response to this is probably, sounds to me similar to the task force's in that it's very interesting, but I don't think anyone is rushing to devise a plan to spend that gap.
no, it'll happen.
Having said that, getting back to my earlier comments, I think that does underscore the sense of this revenue stream as being an asset to protect, because obviously it wouldn't take much to put us upside down.
Yeah.
We see a gap there. We don't really believe that gap is there, but there's margin there that if most of the gap goes away, we're still going to be balanced or close to balance. At the state level, that still looks pretty good, all things considered. Just as an asterisk on that, we don't have it yet. We're going to be looking closer at the local government numbers. But a chart like that would not look anything. A chart like that of the local government numbers would not look anything like it does of the state numbers, where already local expenditures are outpacing growth in local revenues even today. And so as the task force looks at the local government perspective on this, this is going to start to look even better and better compared to what we see on the local side. But I think the task force too has a healthy sense that these numbers are encouraging, they're good, but they're nothing that we would recommend that the legislature start spending today in anticipation of a surplus out 20 years. Too many variables.
One additional population increase was forecast at what, 2% a year, something like that?
Chair Burke, I don't have that number in front of me. I'm looking to Paul to see if he does.
Senator, it's slightly less than 1.5, about 1.4, something in that neighborhood. The U.S. population grows about 1%.
And average revenues, 6%, looked like 12% a biennium, 6% a year, but you really need to reduce that by the population growth, which creates additional needs. So it's you know, assuming inflation continues at least 3 to 4%, and in some instances that are relying upon medical and so on higher than that, it doesn't look like we're going to be awash in money.
Chair Burdick, Senator Monroe, one of the important issues for us, though, is what is the type of in-migration that's coming. Oregon benefited in the early 90s. We had a recession in the early 90s. We had a very similar, actually, when I look back budget-wise, we had a large recession in the 80s. We had a smaller recession in the early 90s. We had a large recession in 2001, 2003. One of the things that benefited us in the 1990 recession is that we actually benefited from what was happening in California, large in-migration from California into Oregon, driving wage earners coming into the state and bringing jobs and other things. So that it depends on what population cohort's moving in to decide if it's a net plus or a net negative for us.
Gotcha.
Chair Burdick and the committee, the rest of this is really about those other things out there that potentially fill that surplus that we talked about. And we wanted to bring a number of them to you. The first one, the first series of slides here around the K-12 or the education system, this is simply a line that shows spending per student, and you all are very familiar with the way that our funding formulas work for the K-12 system, but this is simply a looking at the cost per child in the K-12 system going back to 1990, and the top line is the actual expenditures, and you'll see that they've risen from $4,000 per student up to close to $7,000 per student. We then factored in, if you pull out the impacts of inflation, so to get down to purchasing power, you see that purchasing power actually declined in inflation-adjusted dollars all the way through about 2005, and with the far end of this scale is what you just approved out of this last legislatively approved budget. And you'll see that we have just now come back to what the purchasing power was back in 1990, maybe a little bit higher than that. So we would expect to have continued pressure within our education system, our K-12 system, to increase funding for that system. And as an example of that, you're also familiar with the quality education model. We are currently funding at about 86% of the quality education model with the legislatively adopted budget that was approved this last June. What this chart shows, the bottom section is local resources, the darker section is the state essential budget level or the state contribution under an essential budget level model. If we continued that same projections and we funded it with that essential budget level model, which is what we've built into these forecasts, we're still funding about 86% of what the quality education model would be. The governor's office and others have brought forward a number of proposals, whether it be mandating 10% growth for this system or targeting 61% of the general fund revenues into this system, and that's what we've tried to show if by adding those light bars on the side of it. But we are expecting continued pressure for additional investments in the K-12 system. This is simply a chart of our higher education system, and this one goes back to 1983-85. You'll see a very similar trend if you look at state police. The higher chart on here, or the higher line, is our university system, and you'll notice that back in 83-85, they were about 12 to 13% of the state budget. They now, at the far right, are about 6% of the budget. Now, this chart goes through about 2003-05, and we have not yet updated it for the most recent actions that you have taken, but the trend is still important, the fact that we've over time disinvested in this system. On the healthcare side, on the human services side, this is uninsurance rates for children and adults. The blue line is children ages 0 to 17, and the green line is adults 18 to 64 prior to Medicare kicking in. The thing to note here is back in 1990, we had uninsurance rates for children and adults both in the 18 to 20% range. We made progress through the 90s, and I note for folks that this is twofold. These are uninsurance rates overall for all Oregonians. The two factors in here, the biggest factor in uninsurance rates changing was the strengthening of our economy and the private sector being able to add coverage for their employees and their dependents. As the recession hit companies, they had to disinvest in some of those areas or limit benefits, and that you see starting to happen in the about 2001 period, and you see those uninsurance rates for adults in particular start to rise. Overall, we're still doing worse than we are now, worse in 2006, which is the last year we have data, than we were back in 1990. So the two factors driving this is, one, what was happening in the private sector, but at the same time, the Oregon Health Plan was going through the same type of dynamics as we started running low on revenues. We now have a system within our Oregon Health Plan where what we called the new eligible group, or the people that would not have historically received Medicaid, is no longer funded with state general fund dollars. So at the same time that the private sector was contracting, the state system was doing the same thing. Children, on the other hand, we continue to do better, even though it's not as good as the late 90s, but we have fewer children that are uninsured today than we did in the 90s, which is good news. But again, if you look at this and look at what's happening with the economy, very similar trends based on funding levels. This is our final slide, and we have a couple things for you just to note on here. Starting on the right-hand side of this chart, there are still other pent-up budget demand or pending voter-approved initiatives, and the big one that my office looks at is the repeat property offenders initiative, which could cost, when fully implemented, somewhere in the $275 to $430 million range. So it's a very significant potential impact in the budget long-term. We have not built in yet, and again, as we've talked about here, counter proposals that may be being discussed currently.
On this, in your analysis, there's another initiative that would actually have a positive revenue impact at the state level, and that's the exemption for seniors from property tax, which if they don't pay it, then they can't deduct it, so I assume that would create a positive revenue impact. Did you include that in?
Chair Burdick, actually we did not. And all of these are things that are not covered in our analysis, and that's one that we can work with Paul's shop and get some estimates on. The other pent-up budget demand areas, and these are two that I think are important because they slide under the radar in a lot of areas, is the state and university system and local governments and school districts have a lot of physical buildings out there that we have not been able to keep up with our deferred maintenance costs. Within the state system and the university-owned system, we have approximately $100 million of deferred maintenance costs out there that have not currently been addressed. And then under that, you'll see the seismic issue, which is primarily, we're expecting there's about $750 million of pent-up demand in our K-12 system to deal with retrofitting some of their buildings. So these are issues related to physical plants that we have not been able to keep up with yet, but there will also be future demands. And then on the left side are the other risks to all this, and as we've talked about with the economic downturn, as you've all had conversation, we've had conversation, we've had one revenue forecast that has now gone down, both general fund and lottery fund. We're all waiting to see what happens in June. We will be having tax returns that come in between now and then for the 2007 period, which should provide us some better information. And we will continue to plan around what may happen if various scenarios happen. And we'll be working with state agencies on that. Finally, federal budget adjustments and additional lawsuits that may be out there. There's been a lot of conversation about the state hospital currently, and there are a number of issues popping up around other areas. But these are the other things that we'll be paying attention to over the coming months and years as we look forward. With that, Chair, I am done, unless there's other questions.
Thank you. Very good presentation.
Thank you.
I think Commissioner Morris.
Thank you. Just an editorial comment under other issues. I think a pretty good case can be made in looking at the history of initiatives in this state that we've actually created a structural problem when you have nearly 50% of the growth of expenditures has been driven by specific initiatives, and that brings us up, I think, through 07 by any of it doesn't factor in this one, that what that leaves in its trail and wake are needs that are not reflected just in K-12 or in higher ed or in the uninsured. It's all of the other parts of our budget that have gone under stress because of that growth driven specifically by initiatives. And those are hangover, they continue to hang over into future bienniums. And we see it all the time in terms of that pent-up demand for underserved parts of our budget that have been literally swamped in the wake of the initiatives and potentially will be continue to be swamped given the initiative that's before us. So just as an editorial comment.
And that's, I might add that that's one of the reasons why the tax restructuring task force is including initiative reform in its work plan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to mention that. I think it was a comment that was made at our first meeting, one of the concerns being that using a scenario like this where we're working, given that there are a high degree of number of variables in this forecast methodology, still it gives us something of a framework within which to work that takes into account historic revenue changes, economic upturns and downturns. One of the harder variables to predict ever is the initiative. It really is much more haphazard than the economic cycle. That was an issue I think you might have raised, it, Madam Chair, even yourself at that first meeting, how we take that into account as we develop a long-term revenue methodology that's intended to support a level of programs and services with how do we protect that? How do we guard that against some of these variables? And the initiative was one of those that we can't control and we can't predict, certainly under current law. And that's going to be something the task force will look at. I don't know what the recommendation is going to be, but they're cognizant of it.
No, but it seems to me that we have to have things on the table to try to address it. For example, requiring initiatives that cost money to very clearly identify which taxes will be raised or which programs will be cut. to pay for that, because that's basically what happens in, when these things pass. We've got no choice as a legislature but to either cut programs or raise taxes.
Madam Chair, just responding to that, and I know you've gone long here, I want to thank you for the time that you've put into this, but I think in maybe 2001, 2002, in that period I was a member of the National Conference of State Legislators Initiative and Referendum Reform Task Force, and we looked at the initiative and referendum process in all of the states that have it. And that was actually one of the recommendations that NCUSL made for states that have the initiative process, to consider some sort of a requirement like that in their initiative process. It injects an analogous consideration of what you have in a ways and means process to the initiative. If you're going to be increasing expenditures on one side, it forces you to look at revenues on the other, and by the same token, if you're going to be reducing revenues on another side, then what impacts is that going to have on expenditures? So there are models out there that certainly NCUSL looked at that could inform the consideration the task force gives to that as well.
This is the first time I've ever heard NCSL referred to as
NCUSL. NCUSL is another group that I'm involved with. That's the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. That's a different group. NCSL. It was the NCSL work group that I was involved in on that two-year period. Too many acronyms in my head, Madam Chair. I know it was not LCDC.
That's a bigger leap.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator
Monroe. Yeah, classic example of doing it right was the bill that former Chair Deckard shepherded through the Senate Revenue Committee last session, where he balanced certain tax credits with additional revenues and came out with a package that passed nearly unanimously, I think, in both houses, but it was essentially balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have a net revenue loss. But the one thing you didn't get into today, of course you made reference to it early on, is local government funding. And like as you mentioned earlier, in many ways they're worse off than the state, and it's getting more severe. They're capped at 3% basically, and yet their expenditures are certainly growing faster than that. And then you add to that the situation with the forest fees, especially in the southern rural counties, and there's a crisis, absolute crisis, in county and city funding. Some are trying to meet that with increased fees and so on, but that's certainly a major issue too.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that is something the task force, again, since we have a local focus in the bill as well, we will be getting more information. We're dealing with LOC and AOC, sure of those acronyms, to get the same kind of local government information as we have with the state. As you can understand, it's a lot harder to draw those numbers together in an aggregate because every local government is different. But certainly the picture at the local level is just as you described, with expenditures outpacing revenues, except for those revenues that local governments are able to identify in the way of additional fees, but even those are not keeping pace with the growth in expenditures on a year-to-year basis, for the most part, at the local level. And it's even worse in those counties that are affected by the decline in federal forest funds.
And if the measure that our chair mentioned, some kind of a homestead exemption for seniors or some other kind of property tax reduction for seniors, true, that may have a blip in terms of an increase in terms of state dollars, but it's going to be even more devastating on the local communities that, mm-hmm. that have to provide local services. So,
correct.
You know, if you take away with one hand, you may gain a little with the other hand, but not as much as you take away.
The need for services doesn't go away.
That's exactly right.
Especially since that particular measure is not in any way means tested, so mm-hmm. the impact mm-hmm. would be
age tested.
Draconian, yes. Senator Hass.
Thank you. Lane, you are Oregon's revenue chair emeritus. If anyone deserves to be, you know, jaded or cynical, it would probably be the guy who's been on three or four task forces in the interim before this. And so I just, the fact that you say, well, you're optimistic and maybe we'll find the magic in this hearing tonight, that just is a great reflection on you and on this task force. And so I was kind of interested in if there are new ideas like the green environmental kind of tax ideas that we kind of take a glance at periodically here, if any of those are receiving any traction in this effort?
Thank you, Senator, first of all, for your kind words, and Madam Chair, just to respond, I am optimistic. I'm not a fool. I do read my history, and I've lived a good bit of it. And so there's another reason I do this, and I said this, too, at the first task force meeting, and that is I think government should. I think the state should. Granted that it's a steep hill to climb, and that historically what we end up with are incremental changes, many of them good. Rarely do we achieve fundamental reform in one effort. I still think that it's a worthwhile effort for a state government to periodically reexamine its revenue and its finance system. So I think it's a useful exercise just in the exercise itself. Secondly, as to the question of green tax, nothing at this point has gotten consideration to answer your question directly, but we're moving into a phase in the task force where I have encouraged task force members to use what I'm calling our suggestion box, and we will be devoting time in each meeting for task force members to bring forward revenue proposals. We've got a short amount of time to do this. It seems to me that's probably the fastest way to get ideas on the table, just to invite members to bring them forward, fully formed or even just conceptual. And I fully expect that we'll be hearing about green taxes, carbon taxes, and those kinds of things, just based on the conversation I'm hearing so far from some of our task force members.
Okay. Senator Starr.
Thank you. The question from Senator Haas brought this comment to mind when he said green taxes. I just throw caution out there as it relates to carbon taxes that are levied as a result of vehicle traffic or vehicle movement or freight movement. My goal would be that those kinds of taxes would be sequestered in the Highway Trust Fund. And I know that there's a lot of folks are looking at those kinds of new fees, new taxes as a source of gold. And I think it ought to be cognizant that there is a linkage between those taxes and the use of the highway infrastructure.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, thank you for that. Of course, I can't speak for the task force. I'm very sensitive to that. And the fact is, although we didn't see the transportation numbers up there, it's not as if that's a minefield to be harvested for the general fund. And I think clearly, to the extent that there are revenue proposals to be brought for on the transportation side, my bet is that they're going to be linked very directly, of course, constitutionally for the most part, to infrastructure needs on the transportation side. It's not a pretty picture, as you well know, on the revenue side, and that is not a place that I would expect the general fund to be going to take money from to support non-transportation related programs and services. That would be a difficult case to make in this building and publicly as well, based on my experience.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'll be with you on that one, Bruce. I've looked at the numbers and the total amount of taxes and fees that we charge per automobile in this state is about half of that in surrounding states. And the infrastructure needs in our transportation system are getting worse and worse. So any dollars that we can generate that are auto-related or truck-related need to go into infrastructure for our transportation system.
Any closing comments, parting shots?
No, again, just to thank you for your time here. You've been very generous with us, and I'll be looking forward to seeing the three of you at the March 13 task force meeting, and any of you as well, and we're happy to hear from you online, offline, any way that you want to be involved. Anytime you want us back for another interim committee update, I'm happy to do that, too. So thank you very much for
your
time.
We will avail ourselves of that. Thank you very much. Any other comments from the committee? We are adjourned.